tell me what has motivated you to take the course that you've taken, and then we can go back and talk about your experiences. And the reason I'm asking that is your course has been pretty unusual. And also, a lot of people have talked about how the Jewish community has been so important to the Black community. So could you just give me an overview of your own philosophy and how you came to it that led you on the path that you've taken?
It would be a highly personalized account.
Yeah, that's,
which
yeah.
It is, really.
Okay, yeah, that's what I'm looking for, is your own personal account.
I should perhaps give you something briefly about my background. I was born in a little town called Hemlock, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
It's near Saginaw. My parents came from Russia.
Okay.
My father from Estonia, my mother from the Ukraine. They came separately. They were young people. And they met only because they were both Jewish, and they both lived in small towns
mm-hmm.
in Upper Michigan. And in this case, her uncle and aunt, who were taking care of her, wanted to have the three sisters, she mm-hmm. was one of three sisters, married. And my father happened to be another small town nearby.
So they found him?
Some got in touch through the
mm-hmm.
through the relatives, which mm-hmm. was quite custom
mm-hmm.
marrying.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually met the day before their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
They exchanged photographs before mm-hmm. that, and they got married. And they lived. Father had a grocery, what they call a general store at that time, in Hemlock,
mm-hmm.
and in Kilcullen, Michigan, another one. And then they came to Detroit when I was 5 years old. That would be in 1911. And I was raised in a Jewish family here in Detroit. And I led a life of a young Jewish kid growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Hebrew school, synagogue regularly. Family had a kosher house,
mm-hmm.
that sort of upbringing. And we lived first on Adelaide Street, which is almost
mm-hmm.
downtown here now. And then, over the years, we moved north, Adelaide to Brady,
mm-hmm.
to Garfield, to Palmer, to
mm-hmm.
Euclid,
mm-hmm.
all.
Just skipping a block.
Straight north pattern, and then across Woodward Avenue to the west side, Claremont. 12th Street,
mm-hmm.
and this has some particular interest to what we're talking about, because it was always the Jewish community living in the ghetto, and living in the ghetto was required you to live in housing, which was always the cockroaches, the bed bugs, and
mm-hmm.
the rats were part of the
mm-hmm.
enemy that you had constantly
mm-hmm.
chasing, avoiding, and destroying. And it's always been a part of my record. recollection mm-hmm. as a child over these years. But to the north, to the south of us, as we moved north in this pattern, the black community lived in their ghetto. And it was, even as I recollect at that time, always black people who lived in near us, but mm-hmm. in their own little mm-hmm. ghetto to the south of us. Mm-hmm. As we moved up, it was always the black people and taking over mm-hmm. the old housing, ghetto housing okay. of the Jewish people. And over a period of years, the Jewish people then began to move into new housing, which was mm-hmm. beginning to develop. And the black community moved finally into that, and then across Woodward Avenue moved to 12th mm-hmm. Street. It was a pattern mm-hmm. During that whole period from 1910 somewhere until the 1930s.
It still is?
And it still mm-hmm. is.
Yeah, still. Can you tell me, at what point did you not rent and begin to buy? In other words, at one point were you tenants, and at what point did you become owners?
Well, we were tenants all the way until about 1920, early 1920s, mm-hmm. middle 1920s.
Okay.
Yes, I think probably close to the middle mm-hmm. 1920s. And then for the first time I bought a house, because new houses were being built on the west side, okay. north area.
So the first purchased house was on the Claremont area?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Who owned the houses, all the houses that you rented? You know, what kind of people, you have an idea?
I wouldn't know or remember. My father mm-hmm. took care of mm-hmm. this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have no recollection of it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have ghetto apartments. We mm-hmm. always had ghetto duplexes four apartment houses,
mm-hmm.
or single houses, old frame houses.
Mm-hmm.
So I never lived in a ghetto big apartment house.
So even at that point, there were the absentee landlords that didn't maintain their houses.
I'm not sure whether some of the places the landlord lived in one of the mm-hmm. flats.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite common.
Okay.
The family would buy a house mm-hmm. on a contract and then pay it off by getting a rent from mm-hmm. the two or three other tenants.
Okay.
But there were no, none of the crowding within small rooms
mm-hmm.
we had. The city was expanding,
mm-hmm.
at least for the Jewish mm-hmm. people, to the point where we always had adequate housing. Sometimes mm-hmm. it was a house above a store.
Mm-hmm.
Father would operate the grocery store mm-hmm. or dry goods mm-hmm. store, and then on the second mm-hmm. floor we would live.
Mm-hmm.
That was another way of trying to make ends meet
mm-hmm.
for us, mm-hmm. little businessman, which mm-hmm. my father was. Okay. I lived this kind of a life, a Jewish life within itself. I didn't know any Gentile people,
mm-hmm.
hardly at all. You didn't have cars, and people lived near where they worked and lived near where the synagogue was and where the other Jewish people were and all mm-hmm. their relatives were. It was an insular kind of a
mm-hmm.
life for most of those years mm-hmm. as a child. then I guess when I finished high school, when I started to go to high school, Central High School, which was the one which is the old Wayne building, Wayne University. And I went through there, and experiences there were tied into the Jewishness of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And especially being singled out as Jewish and not being able to participate in the life of the other non-Jewish students who ran, politically ran the school.
Mm-hmm.
It resulted during the last part of the high school career in a bloody battle, really, outside school itself. We could watch it. It occurred between the Rough House Jewish guys who had an organized gang, pretty much, out of which grew the, what was called the Purple Gang in the late 1920s. They were our friends because they protected us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this battle between the WASPs and the Jews there did open my eyes to the nature of our society and where we lived too, in the process of moving from place to place. Always battles going on between, in our neighborhood, was usually the Poles and the Jews. If you go past the borderline, you're likely to get beaten up by one of their groups. They came over. Some of the guys on our side would reciprocate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Detroit at that time was cut up into all these different ethnic and racial and religious groups around the city. And each one lived their own kind of life, just like I've described in mine, pretty much. Their own foods, their own restaurants, their own traditions, their own religious institutions and so forth. Looking back on it, it was a fascinating pattern we had here in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had more different recognized groups geographically, ethnic, racial, other groups, than perhaps most or any other large cities, kind of because they all came to Detroit to work in the factories here.
Mm-hmm.
They'd heard about it. And, was for a long time, it was a very interesting kind of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's all gone.
We were talking about the bloody battle and the Purple Gang.
Right. The after, during the end of my high school, I began to start thinking about myself. Thinking by yourself as a growing adolescent boy, you have to prove your independence from your parents, and one way was to challenge a religion, religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as a result of that, not an immediate one, but certainly for a period of time, I really lost all my religious teaching, faith.
Mm-hmm.
And became an agnostic, I suppose, at the end of that period. But it opened my eyes to a lot of other things as well, literature and other cultural things that I came across and learned about in the process. But in the, I became a lawyer in 1928, going to law school. Years for that, and I started to practice law in fall of 1928, just before the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Went to practice with two other friends of mine who were in the same graduating class. Mm-hmm. And we had a scrounge for a living. The Depression came, it was more and more difficult to do so. And I began to see what was happening in society within the next 2-3 years. I had never even thought about you. Mm-hmm. What's causing the unemployment, what's causing people mm-hmm. to be hungry, causing my father to lose his job. And I began to read a lot of the literature, magazines, mm-hmm. newspapers, anything. Mm-hmm. And this began to open my eyes to the nature of society as it existed. And up to this point, my life had been based on the assumption by my family, myself, and everybody else that I would go to school, become a professional of one kind or another, a lawyer or a doctor. Mm-hmm. This was usually the choice that was given to mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. Mother favored the doctor. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty good. But eventually I decided that I didn't want to be a doctor, so I became a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Not because I knew anything about it or cared anything mm-hmm. about it, but just having a friend of mine was playing tennis. He played tennis a lot at that time. And he was going to law school. And since I wanted to go to school and didn't want to go to work in a factory, mm-hmm. if I could even find a job, mm-hmm. he said, why don't you come there? And that's how I began to become interested in law. Life has its peculiar vagary. So when I was going to law school, I hoping to succeed financially and mm-hmm. and socially and rise up in society and mm-hmm. have a lot of money and all the things that go along with it. This was my thought, mm-hmm. other than very idealistic mm-hmm. thoughts that were not realistic at all. But when the Depression came and I was faced with it, I began to find out that the work I was doing as a lawyer was all of it. It was on behalf of small companies, credit companies particularly, trying to collect money from poor people who had bought stuff on credit. And the more I did that kind of work, the more I felt that spend my life on it. Over the next, 4 or 5 years, say from 1929, 1930 to about 1934 or 35, I made the decision to leave. Fortunately, all the different things my partners were doing in terms of making money didn't go very well, and we went broke. So I heaved a sigh of relief at that point. I didn't know how to get out of this rat trap that I was mm-hmm. in, this cage that I found myself mm-hmm. closed in. And then I began to find something else to do on behalf of people, individual human beings, and not companies, and mm-hmm. not just to collect money from people who can't afford to pay it, and that sort of thing. So I joined a number of organizations around, and I could find the American Civil Liberties Union. That was very early, probably about 1935. Mm-hmm. And then a Professional League for Civil Rights, so-called. And then the Civil Rights Federation. And
let me just interrupt you for a minute.
Pardon?
At this point, what was it that made you do this? In other words, why did you see, you saw unfairness? What did you see that
I saw
made you feel you wanted to do something?
I saw first people unemployed, mm-hmm. walking around, doing nothing, selling apples on the corner. Mm-hmm. And these were people, you know, who looked intelligent, mm-hmm. just didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. I saw my father losing his source of work presence. And then I began to read about it, began to understand what was happening, not only here around me, but all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to understand that people were being destroyed for no reason that I could see that was logical or intelligible. And I then saw what I was doing as an individual, as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I was working on behalf of a system that was destroying the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to realize that I was becoming a part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a decision. I didn't want that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to fight on behalf of the people who were being oppressed and do something to help them that I could use law for.
Mm-hmm.
I always used law for purposes I didn't want, care for, despise, as a matter of fact. So it was this juxtaposition of life as it was around me when I began to learn about it being elsewhere, some of the causes, the cost. And then contrasting that with what I was doing brought about my my conclusion, or really became a strong, hard conclusion. I'm going to do something about this as much as I can. The only thing I began to feel sorry about is that I'd wasted all these years when I could have been something, doing something.
Not that many.
It did at the time. It seemed like a lot. You know. Yeah, it seemed like a lot. So, in that connection, for the first time I met black people. I never met black people on any social level at all.
Mm-hmm.
Even working. And then these organizations were black people as well as white people. And the aliens, non-citizens who were living here, many of them of different countries, different personalities, different cultures, you know. And I began to find out what wonderful things they could teach me and I could learn from them. And ideas were so different, enabled me to expand my view of life. And of the world at the same time. I should say something that during this period, perhaps, about my how I developed my relationship with the black community, if you want me to, on this one. Well, let me give you one illustration of what I began to learn. And how different the culture of white people were from black people. We didn't even understand it. I didn't understand it. I'm sure most whites didn't either. As I began to engage in this kind of political kind of work, I was asked to speak from time to time. I began to learn how to speak to people in meetings, you know. And I was invited to speak at a black church on a Sunday morning. It's a church service. I forget what the subject was about, really. But what I do remember is that on Sunday, of course, I would put on my Sunday clothes, which means my older clothes. Comfortable clothes, you know, not the suits that I would wear, and a shirt and a tie. And I thought, well, it's Sunday, I'll just go over there. So I went, and it was a storefront church. And I've never been in a storefront church inside of it before. I got the address and I went there. And I walked in without a jacket, without a tie, and shirt and trousers, you know. And as I walk in, I saw these people there. all dressed up in their Sunday best. You know? I realized, my God, what I couldn't walk up again. And I did not do so. I sat down, and everybody was looking at me. And I felt like shrinking up into myself. Finally, the pastor saw me. Was called on me to say a few words on this subject, but he introduced it by saying, doesn't understand the custom, I guess, about Sunday church. Mm-hmm. He's just come from home or made some excuse of the sort. And I felt so embarrassed at that. I spoke, but I began to realize that I just didn't understand the culture of the black community. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have gone to a white church the way I was dressed, but I did to the black church because I didn't understand. And one's lessons of this kind over a period of years was helped me to feel comfortable with black people and to be able to mentally erase the pattern of conduct that I had learned as a child from the time I was a child. And a short black person, Schwarz, I would call black people, Yiddish, my mother. Somehow not as good as us. This is the only saw when I was a child, a black person as a servant. And I hope my mother would be able to get somebody to help. And it's a slow, difficult process for anybody to learn. And that was the beginning of it. So that In beginning to work in these organizations, especially as a lawyer, because there were not very many lawyers who were mostly workers, I began to also understand working people. I mean, people who worked in factories. There are not too many Jewish people who worked in factories. They worked in other places, not in factories. Drive a horse and wagon around the alleys picking up the odds and ends, make a living that way. They may work in a store or have a little store of their own.
But a more independent living.
Not in factories. A few of my relatives did, but very few. So I began to learn about working people, their problems, who they were. Too, began to understand and talk to them and learn. And this was a great learning process. It was a part of a new way of looking at life and society as well. And where should we go?
Then let's get into your...
It's probably a lot too long.
No, no. Okay. Not for me.
Right.
I don't know how your time is. But now let's get into your, you know, now your career and how your career moved along and the kinds of cases that you had and why and...
Okay. Well, this... I'm getting into about 1935, 6, and 37. These were great years. I mean, great years in the sense of tremendous movements developing all over the community, the city, organizing labor unions, organizing tenants, and trying to get food for people in some fashion. Mm-hmm. All these were real political struggles. And of course, most important one was the labor movement struggle, because this was known as an open open employment town, no union town, no unions of any consequence here. It had been kept out for years. The laws in the state were such as to make it very, very difficult for a union to even organize. Peaceful picketing was not permitted. Injunctions would be issued, people put in jail for peaceful picketing. So that there was no way in which working people could peacefully organize a labor union, except in the smaller side industries, but certainly nothing in the automobile industry. But none. The only way they had to do what we now consider a right in the Constitution, that we believe is necessary to a democratic society, was not possible in a city like Detroit. And so other means had to be used. Usually it was by violating the law, going on a picket line, trying to close the plant or to force the employer to bargain for a contract. And so they'd be arrested, put in jail. They were lawbreakers. And a few of us at that time who were concerned with labor union organizing were doing much of the work. There were only a few lawyers who were doing it. Labor unions were considered communist instruments at that time, generally it's considered. The press and the radio, all in the hands of the employers, and they completely supported the employers. There was no alternate newspaper here to take the side of working people. People were being evicted from their houses. Those who were protesting for food. And there was no way in which a lawyer could make a living doing that kind of work if none of these people had any money to pay a lawyer. In addition to becoming a social pariah in your profession, there was no such thing as a labor lawyer. Labor law was under the heading of master and servant in the books, legal books. And it was in this kind of an atmosphere that for me this presented just the kind of opportunity I was looking for, you know, to get into a political legal struggle. As a lawyer, I could do it. It's a political legal struggle to fight within a struggle with which I identified myself against those whom I thought were completely culpable. And oppressive through the use of my skill as a lawyer. It was a wonderful opportunity. Instead of using the instrumentalities of law to help evict people from houses, to take away their furniture if they failed to make payments on them, that sort of thing, foreclose contracts. I was trying to use it for this purpose.
Can you explain why your attitude was different than the attitude of your parents?
Than my parents? Well,
or was it so different?
They were not hostile to it.
They just accepted the notion.
But they didn't. They loved me very much, and especially my mother. She had two children. I had a sister and myself. And so anything I did, so it must be right, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it.
That's how I
that was very
treat
helpful.
My son.
That was helpful in many ways, because as things became a little tougher, the CIO was organized, and it was attacked all through the country as a communist organization. Matter of fact, I remember billboards. 1936 all over the country during the election, saying join the CIO and build a Soviet America.
Oh.
That attack was going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Join the CIO and become communist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was involved constantly mm-hmm. in handling these kinds mm-hmm. of cases.
Mm-hmm.
My name got into the paper quite often.
Mm-hmm.
I was representing CIO. My mother and her friends heard about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget what day she came to me and said, very cautiously, Ernie, friends say you're active in the CIO.
Mm-hmm.
You represent CIO. I said, she asked, are they all right? I said, mm-hmm. I hear that, tell me they're no good.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should think about it.
Mm-hmm.
She was hesitant to mm-hmm. criticize.
Mm-hmm.
So she put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I could give a dissertation on the nature of society
mm-hmm.
and that there are two sides to mm-hmm. much of it, the workers and the bosses mm-hmm. that are in a struggle for something that the workers believed in. And so I said, look, I said, Mama, do you think I would do anything wrong? And she looked at me and said, no. I said, well, don't worry. That satisfied her. But it gives you a...
That sounds like my son, too.
Okay.
And it's funny, I'm going to tell him about you because he says to me, you're always telling me I'm wonderful. You're always, you know, why are you always doing that? So I'm telling him it pays off.
Well, you see, life changes, but many aspects of it
right.
continue it, which is good.
It's the right instinct.
But it became very, very difficult. Courts were completely hostile.
Mm-hmm.
And you go in the criminal courts where people are arrested for beating somebody on a picket line,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. Except for two judges. One was Frank Murphy, later became
mm-hmm.
governor, and the other was Jeffries.
Mm-hmm.
Great old socialist in the early days of this century.
Mm-hmm.
And you get in front of those two where nobody would ever get convicted.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, most of the judges out there
mm-hmm.
were vicious.
Mm-hmm.
So I became involved in this, and then Roosevelt New Deal began to develop, especially in 1936. 35, 36, many of the new laws were being developed to help the people who were poor, impoverished, mm-hmm. farmers, unemployed, provide social security.
Mm-hmm.
Major, major changes appeared in our society
mm-hmm.
through these measures. They were being opposed at every level and every way possible
mm-hmm.
by the Employers Association, Chambers of Commerce,
mm-hmm.
American Legion, and so on. And my understanding of the political nature of our society began to develop as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
As September 1936, President Roosevelt was under such attack by employers for his New Deal measures. The employers were completely supported by the American Bar Association. And they were supporting the judges of the Supreme Court
mm-hmm.
who were holding these laws to be unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that and efforts on the part of lawyers who were representing the oppressed people in our mm-hmm. society at the same time, to try to get an organization together mm-hmm. where they could work together for a common objective.
Mm-hmm.
Coincided, and the National Lawyers Guild was formed in late 1936. And I didn't hear about it until a little while later. The idea that he did a joint and asked to do some work on it. And when I was waiting for it to be able, as a lawyer, mm-hmm. to participate in changing of society, was a wonderful opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I became the executive secretary of the local chapter, and I spent a lot of my time working in that organization. So that both in these civil rights organizations, mm-hmm. Civil Rights Federation, and legal organization, mm-hmm. I now have two organizational vehicles through which I can continue to develop my thoughts, my ideas, my activity, and expand my work as much as was possible for me to do. So these all coincided. In our legal association, by the way, the National Lawyers Guild, black lawyers became members. The American Bar Association wouldn't take any black members in their organization at all. This was another difference between the established structures of our society and what was developing with the movement of the people under leadership at that time of Roosevelt, moving in new directions. So one important thing that happened to me then was that 1935, I think it was, I was campaigning for a person who had been a partner of mine at the time we dissolved our firm. And I,
mm-hmm.
But I said I would speak for him. I went out to some meetings for candidates for a judge
mm-hmm.
for running. And at one meeting, in the home of a black man, I spoke for my friend, and I listened to the other speakers. Well, there were about six or seven speakers there that night, sitting at the dining room table,
mm-hmm.
and the chairs were set in the living room where the people were mm-hmm. to listen. And it turned out that there were only two or three black people there.
Mm-hmm.
So the owner, the fellow who called the meeting, went around upstairs and neighbors and brought in some more, so mm-hmm. there were 10 or 12, but mm-hmm. there hardly any more than there were mm-hmm. candidates mm-hmm. speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But one other person who came up to speak then was a man named Maurice Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I heard somebody speak about the nature of our society, analyzing it in a way that anybody could understand, but which conveyed the important ideas, suddenly hit me. Only candidates I'd ever heard speak during this period were those who would say, look, especially to black people, only to black people,
mm-hmm.
look, I help black people. I have a washerwoman. Black was a job too. A chauffeur, is a black man, and so on. You know, that's sort of the level of political speaking.
And savvy.
This man come out mm-hmm. and talks about the nature of society, mm-hmm. blacks and whites,
mm-hmm.
why blacks are where they are and whites
mm-hmm.
where they are,
mm-hmm.
and why that need not be, and
mm-hmm.
how to change it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of his speech for electing him to a judge. Well, I soon found out more about Sugar. He
mm-hmm.
was one of the organizers of the National Lawyers Guild, and I went to see him.
National
Lawyers Guild,
oh, okay.
organization, and legal organization we formed here. And the there weren't many, and he, well, put it this way, he was one of the two or three lawyers in the United States who were known as labor lawyers, and mm-hmm. spent his life developing, working for, and fighting on behalf of labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
And he had ideas about the nature of society, and he was knew all the great radicals of his period mm-hmm. of time, Taumini, and mm-hmm. and the other, I can't remember their names at the moment. But
do you remember what he said? Do you, can you remember anything?
Not specifically. Mm-hmm. I remember generally what mm-hmm. he said. And but he then saw my interest in what I wanted to do, and he began to call on me to do handle some labor work, which I knew nothing about. I never went to school and never read anything about it. Mm-hmm. But he said, get into it. I'll give you some matters, labor matters mm-hmm. you can handle. I began to handle in 1936 and 37.
Mm-hmm.
And I then went to the National Labor Relations Board in 1937, which was just been created here in Detroit in 1936. Mm-hmm. And the attorney for the National Labor Relations Board, Harold Cranefield,
mm-hmm.
he began to help me and teach me what labor law was about and mm-hmm. how to handle these cases. Became a very good friend of mine over the years. And this is how I got into the labor movement
mm-hmm.
and into the progressive political movement and the civil rights movement. They're combined in various mm-hmm. ways in those days. They're all working together.
Mm-hmm.
The Civil Rights Federation was an organization composed of about 100 different organizations and labor unions
mm-hmm.
and organizations of the unemployed and of the non-citizen groups, mm-hmm. the ethnic groups, and so forth. They had a lot of matters coming before them. I worked there a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Helped edit their little newspaper we put out, as well as handle legal matters that came mm-hmm. in. People were constantly getting arrested. Those days, the police were a force that was solely under the control of the employers of this state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they dominated it from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to which, the employers had private detectives, agencies of detectives working for them, full-time basis. We called them later, and the strikes began as goons, company mm-hmm. goons. So
it's sort of like the Bennetts? The Bennetts.
A lot of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Police, a lot of it came from the police.
Mm-hmm.
And then so much of it was had been directed to the black community,
mm-hmm.
to the black people. They were treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
And there, let me give you something of that.
Mm-hmm.
First place, the black lawyers, none of them had offices in the area where all the main lawyers of the community mm-hmm. lived, downtown offices. Theirs was a couple, one or two office buildings on Broadway, just off
mm-hmm.
Ratchet.
Mm-hmm.
And they were treated in courts differently.
Mm-hmm.
They were called by their first name. Circumstances were didn't call for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when blacks, let me say the criminal courts especially, this is true, were witnesses, let's say, or defendants, they were always called by their first name. Nobody called them Mr. So-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And at a point later on when I was handling those cases, I began to call Mr. So-and-so. Mm-hmm. The judge would look up at you. He didn't stop you.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly wondered what was going on here.
Uh-huh.
Just like in the South at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Blacks were treated. And for a black, you know, black lawyer had very few opportunities of practicing law other than criminal law, divorces perhaps, small business transactions perhaps, and other of the narrow areas that existed out of the mainstream
mm-hmm.
of law. Very, there were some very good lawyers who managed to survive at a
mm-hmm.
somewhat higher level, but that was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And the treatment by the police of the black community was a complete disregard of their rights. They would arrest a person, a black person, hold them for about as long as they wanted, and by that, a week, 2 weeks, sometimes even longer. If a lawyer attempted to get them out because there were no charges brought against them, they would not have been brought to court.
Mm-hmm.
The police would transfer them from one precinct to another precinct, and the judges would not acknowledge it unless you served the subpoena at the precinct where the prisoner actually was at the time. You'd play this merry-go-rounds.
Mm.
And they would...
Are you talking about a specific period now?
I'm talking about the period when I became acquainted with this in the 1935,
okay.
36, in there. And on through that for many, many years.
Yeah. That was why I asked you what period you were speaking of, because I know this, I hear this many, well, I hear of police harassment today.
Yes, but of a sort
that
you would have, most people might associate only with the segregation in the South. They would get confessions out of almost most people that they brought in on
mm-hmm.
any important crime. They figure this is the person who did it. It was very difficult for them to investigate a crime
mm-hmm.
in the black community, let's say,
mm-hmm.
because there are no black policemen, or maybe
mm-hmm.
one or two somewhere stuck away.
Mm-hmm.
But all white policemen, they didn't want to go in the black community and start trying to solve a crime. They had no communication
mm-hmm.
with the black community.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to solve some crimes. Otherwise, it looked bad for them. They didn't solve some crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So they use the easy methods,
mm-hmm.
beat a confession out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was typical. I don't know how many thousands of people went to
mm-hmm.
prison for crimes that they confessed to which they didn't
uh-huh.
commit. It must be thousands. I don't know. I could only surmise. But so many experiences of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only way, ultimately, over the years, I found to meet that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Testing all the time, which
mm-hmm.
we did, was they took a confession from a person, they wrote it out. They didn't do an investigating job, usually very good one.
Mm-hmm.
So usually they'd put in the confession something that I could later prove was not true.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury then would listen to the confession.
Mm-hmm.
Today they have some safeguards. In those days you just try the man and put in
mm-hmm.
the confession. And the man gets on his hand
mm-hmm.
and says, I didn't sign that. I mean, I didn't
mm-hmm.
agree to that, but I had to sign it because it was being done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of the time they believe the all-white jury would
mm-hmm.
believe the all-white police
mm-hmm.
force
mm-hmm.
with the all-white judges
mm-hmm.
and the all-white clerks. So you look through this confession and try to find something that you could prove was not true.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while I was able to do it. But if you did that, you felt it
mm-hmm.
somehow wasn't any anything that made up for all of the horrors of the
mm-hmm.
past or
mm-hmm.
that were going on. But at least you got some satisfaction
mm-hmm.
in showing up to these guys. Can and do lie.
Yeah.
And in those cases, the jury would frequently
mm-hmm.
acquit.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the kind of thing you had to do. And what chance did a black person have in a court to win a case? And what chance did he have if he had a black lawyer?
Yeah.
He thought he had even less, which he did. Because
yeah.
a black lawyer would suffer the,
mm-hmm.
the
same indignities.
Penalty of
mm-hmm.
being a black in a white
mm-hmm.
community, in a white courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it was true in all cases or not, in some cases it would not have been
mm-hmm.
true, but in most cases it probably was.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, to the ordinary black person who needed to do something to help
mm-hmm.
him, either some financial problem that he'd been into or in a criminal case,
mm-hmm.
he'd get a white lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever good business there was in the black community would usually go to white lawyers, not to black lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
The times were tough
mm-hmm.
for the black lawyers in those days. And I handled a number of cases over the years involving black people.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the most interesting, important cases. Black people.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I still have
mm-hmm.
done that. In our office today,
mm-hmm.
I guess we handle
mm-hmm.
cases of black and elsewhere. But that's another story.
It's another story? Can you give me?
A later one.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like a couple of examples.
Well, let's take the Lee Mosley case. Now, this
okay.
was much later, but
mm-hmm.
it's a good example. This was about 1947, I guess, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or somewhere 50 in there. But this was typical of
mm-hmm.
the problems of obtaining justice for a black person
mm-hmm.
in our courts here. Lee Mosley, I think, was a 14-year-old black young boy. And he was seen on the street by somebody, a policeman, who were on patrol, either in a car or street patrol, I forget which
mm-hmm.
at the time. And there had been a report of a rape.
A rape?
At the time.
Someone else said it was a.
Or maybe
that
it was
he stole a loaf of bread or something.
Maybe it was a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
I better leave that out because
okay.
I had so many cases involving
okay.
rape charge. So, but there had been a lot of newspaper publicity about. Crimes being committed in this area where white people still lived. And so this policeman with his partner saw this young boy running. Why he was running, I don't know, nobody knows. But he was running, they ran up an alley.
Mm-hmm.
They had guns. They shot him in the back. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had no evidence this man had committed
mm-hmm.
any crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, because of the newspaper publicity,
mm-hmm.
they
were going to be heroes.
They shot and killed him. And the community, the black community, was outraged at this
mm-hmm.
one killing. murder. And we got, say we, the organizations of, well, it must have been after 1950, because George Crockett was in this case too. Was it 1951, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so we finally put enough pressure so that a coroner, at that time there was a coroner here, appointed what he had a legal right to do, and was customary under old English procedure, mm-hmm. law, and early American procedure, mm-hmm. to have a citizen's jury sit where the coroner thought that there was some evidence of a crime, and determine whether, in their opinion, there was a crime,
mm-hmm.
and who was the person,
mm-hmm.
who they thought might have committed the crime. And that session in the coroner's court called a jury, got them together. They were a sort of blue ribbon jury, as they call it. People of social,
mm-hmm.
political status. And there were, I think there were half a dozen jurors. And we took testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And George Crockett, who was my partner at the time, and myself, and he was a black lawyer too.
Mm-hmm.
Just forget his name. As I go on with this sort of thing, my memory gets worse.
Yeah, well, you're doing awfully good.
And so we tried the case, and they had the prosecuting, not a prosecuting attorney, an attorney there, Judge Szymanski, later became a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And he took testimony of all the witnesses. There was a lot of publicity on this case, a lot of community, mm-hmm. interest in this case. And so at the end, the jury found that the death of Lee Mosley was the result of unnecessary and illegal acts on the part of these policemen,
mm-hmm.
two policemen. And as a result of that, the prosecutor then issued a warrant for their arrest. He was reluctant to do it. That happens. Such a warrant had never been issued before,
mm-hmm.
this kind, against policemen for shooting somebody in the course of their duty, trying to uphold the law.
Mm-hmm.
You always hold the policeman.
Mm-hmm.
Most you might give them a few days off or something,
mm-hmm.
but to charge them with,
mm-hmm.
Manslaughter,
mm-hmm.
they didn't charge them with murder, they charged them with manslaughter. And we were looking forward to the trial. The prosecutor, of course, was the one who had to prosecute the officer.
Mm-hmm.
That we knew was bad because they function together, they work together, and they,
mm-hmm.
have a common interest.
Right.
Certainly did at that time. And so instead of it being a jury trial, which is what was wanted there, the defendants lawyer, when they found out that the case was assigned to Judge Arthur Gordon, the recorder's court,